Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. This week, we're off to Lebanon.
Clearly, design is much bigger than this. It's a discipline, it's a thinking, it's something that we use in every single decision that we make in our daily lives.
We're in Beirut, where the city's Design Week has just wrapped up. Under the theme, Design and the City, its goal was to encourage designers and planners to engage more in solving Beirut's many urban issues. With a number of projects being displayed in public spaces, one street in particular, Jeanne d'Arc, has become a live experiment for what some tactical urbanism can do to improve quality of life in the Lebanese capital. We dispatched our contributor, David Michon, to tell us all about Beirut Design Week 2018. So stay with us over the next 30 minutes, because that's all coming up right here on The Urbanist.
One of my favorite writers, the journalist and author Jan Morris, wrote of Beirut in the 1960s that it was the impossible city. Impossible in the enchantment of its setting between the Lebanese mountains and the Mediterranean, impossible in the headiness of its character, infiltrating all the senses, and impossible in its economics, commanding no great resources. Just as the bumblebee is aerodynamically incapable of flying, Morris writes, so Beirut, by all rules and precedents, shouldn't really exist. Yet it does, defiantly, energetically, tirelessly. The city is a marvel, for good and for bad. Intoxicating and exciting as it may be, it is not without major points of friction. A 15-year-long civil war ending in 1990 caused incredible damage to the city, destroying much of its downtown, the war's front line. And, unfortunate for Beirutis, the downtown's redevelopment has been driven by corruption and greed, not the public good. Quiet streets and empty shopfronts seem a silent protest to what's happened there, as chaotic and gritty neighborhoods such as Marmakel or Hamra buzz along, despite a lack of green space, sidewalks cluttered with obstructions, debilitating traffic, and the encroaching cranes and scaffolding of property barons. This is why, for Beirut Design Week's 7th edition, the theme is the city. Beginning at the end of June, the week sees major exhibitions in the capital and in Tripoli, open studios, and several public projects aimed at transforming public space. It is a festival that challenges what a design week can talk about, with themes such as governance and access on top of object and spatial design, and bravely reorients focus away from luxury and onto impact. This year, its creative director is Hassan Salameh, a designer in his own right, whose work challenges the limits of traditional craftsmanship. I interviewed him on the terrace of the Arts and Cultural Foundation, Dar El Nimar, host to several Design Week events.
So the idea was, first, two things basically contributed in this decision. The first one was wanting to introduce design as not only luxury design, furniture design, product design, since the design scene in Beirut is mostly concentrated around these disciplines. Most of the designers want to work with famous galleries. Furniture galleries have collectible design or work towards creating unique pieces. My issue with this is that clearly design is much bigger than this. It's a discipline, it's a thinking, it's something that we use in every single decision that we make in our daily lives. Like, we design our lives on a daily basis, and design for me was not only about an object. The object is important for our lives, making an object is important, but design is not only about that. So basically, I wanted to just expand this notion of design not only being about product or furniture. And mainly, I wanted the students graduating from universities, when they call themselves designers, not to have one goal in their minds, which is ending up in a gallery, because this is not where design should be represented. That's one. Two, another thing that also I found problematic, I always found problematic in Beirut, which is the lack of collaborations. And this is also, I believe, is a part of the problem of being in this contemporary art era that we're living in, and contemporary design era, this whole idea about collectors and selling art, buying art, international design fairs, that became a little bit like a standardized ways of selling design, as if it's the only way where designers could be represented. created ideas of superstar designers, superstar collectors, superstars curators. And I wanted to challenge this notion as well, because I believe that this is not what design is as well. And the third ingredient was me wanting to make a difference or change. That's always been something that I thought that I'm gonna do through my work or through my personal design work, which is make a difference, make a change, as silly, as idealist as it seems, like changing the world. But that's something that I always wanted to do. Like a lot of the creatives living here, a lot of people my age, on this age range living in Lebanon, the only solution always seems to be, when frustration grows, is to travel and move and live abroad. And for me, it was either I have to do that or I have to change the place where I live in. So the idea was to get the designers to engage with the other experts, with other people living in the city, the dwellers, the citizens, the residents, and to try to come up with solutions to make the cities better livable places.
Do you feel like Lebanon or Beirut has a particular point of view? I mean, is there a kind of Lebanese or Beiruti mindset in terms of approaches to urban solutions?
The fact that there was really no clear master planning for the city, if we're talking about infrastructure or urbanism, doesn't really make our life easier, because you cannot really identify one problem. The fact that the issue is so big, so it's always hard for us to decide where to start. We're always arriving a little bit at the end when things get super obvious, and then we start identifying the problem and then we go and start interfering. And this happens a lot with the activism work that's happening here. So we get messages at some point that, okay, there's a building in Hamra that's a heritage building, is being destroyed. Let's go over, like, let's go Monday morning, demonstrate, protest. So we're always arriving a little bit late when things are really happening, because there are so many things that are going wrong in different directions that we're not really aware or we're not really organized. So I think the role of design here is to maybe design strategies or design systems that can actually predict these types of issues that are happening, to organize the way we work a little bit in relation of making an impact in the city. And another thing that I want to bring into the conversation as well, when we talk about the different problems that are happening here, and everyone I think here would tell you that nothing's working, infrastructure, electricity, transportation, pollution, like we have issues on so many different levels. It is very clear that the cause of this is because there's lack of engagement from the public sector. It's basically not existence. It's not even active. It's not doing its job. It's just a spectator, and it's run by politicians who own private companies that are benefiting from this corruption or the status quo. So the idea is that, what can we do? Can we just wait, sit, and, you know, complain and say that it's never going to change because they're too powerful, they have mafias, whatever, that we cannot make any difference? Because obviously, if we ask them, and we tried this, to complain and ask and go on TV and campaign and ask them to do their job, and they're not willing to do it. So one of the things that I think this year we managed to do in a way or the other was to actually do the job for them, which is really coming up with proposals that are finished, executable, and then try to propose it for them. When I say them, is public institutions that are responsible for the different sectors, to actually make a difference.
And of Beirut Design Week's program, perhaps few projects exemplify this desire for social impact more than the transformation of one street, Jeanne d'Arc. After a long-fought-for improvement to its pedestrian infrastructure, widening a footpath by, controversially, removing a row of parking, architect, activist, and educator at the American University, Mona Al-Halek, has helped to curate more than 20 projects to transform the street even further. Some are temporary, others permanent, all hope to show a way forward for Beirut. On the day I met Mona, the mayor of Beirut had just toured.
The whole idea was that AUB is a university that has the duty to do something good for the neighborhood. And that's what we're trying to do, to create participatory projects that would benefit the neighborhood on one side by solving its problems, and benefit the university on the other side by offering the students a practical and problem-solving, real, critical citizenship experience.
Projects range from permanent art installations, a temporary mural for the community to color in, a library shelf along the street, and proposals on how to green Beirut's many parking lots. One project, a bench, is a highlight. On a kind of long boom that swings across a small piazza, it's part planter, part seating, part memorial to the neighborhood. You can walk it from one side of the piazza to the other, following the sun, or to be near to one shop or the other. Mona showed me how it works.
This is the only street in Beirut other than in downtown and the Corniche where you can actually walk from one street to another for like half a kilometer without being obstructed, without one pedestrian obstacle. And even for it was inclusive for wheelchairs, for strollers, even for the visually impaired, there is tactile tiling at every intersection. We have benches and we have trees. For you, this is normal. For us, there are no benches on the streets of Beirut. There are no trees really like regularly on the. So we wanted to give a role model for the municipality. So the students wanted to do a memorial of this, an urban memorial of this street. And what they did is they introduced this 9-meter-long planter. This is our students' work, which has a bench at its edge. And it rotates because it has an element of play. And what happens is as you rotate on the ground, there's a plate that has engraved in it the 70 quotes that the 70 shops in this street gave about what they feel about the street. So I'm going to sit now with two of you and pedal. Pedaling in process. And as you, of course, you don't read Arabic, but you see this is number 20, the shop. And you can read what he said. So someone said, I met my wife here. Somebody said, I have met my wife here. Somebody said, this is Little New York. Somebody said, this is the vein of Hamra. Somebody said, it's the best years of my life. Somebody said, it's very, very classy. Somebody said, it combines all religions. Somebody said, it reminds me of my parents. Somebody said, it's, you know, a beautiful thing. So the thing is also now, this was totally an empty piazza. Nobody comes here. So now they sit here, they take their coffee, they pedal back and forth. People are coming to read what other people have said about the street. So it became a community. It's starting to create a community. In the afternoon, you would see there are people that come here and just, you know, do things.
And how do people kind of react if maybe people aren't used to kind of spending time in public spaces like this or having a place to sit down in a piazza? Like, what
the
is
first the opposition was the actual owners. Mm. And why do we want to have a bench? Because the people will come and sit on it. You know, but then that's the point. And then we took it one step at a time. We said, let's try it, because this has been here for a month, because it was the final project of the students. And they actually slowly fell in. And we said, we're ready to remove it if you're not happy with it. So we just took it one step at a time, and now they're very happy with it. It's really foreign to them that on their own property, because it's not public, this is a private piazza, the street stops there. So they gave us the opportunity to activate their private piazza, and I'm very happy that they're very happy with it.
And you're saying now that the shop owners keep wanting to have the bench close to their...
Yeah, that shop owner thinks if the bench is to his side, the people will be directed to him.
Jean d'Arc is busy when we visit, but despite this, it feels less chaotic than elsewhere in the city. Pedestrians aren't stumbling into the streets to avoid poles or parking meters, for example. But not everyone was pleased when the works were completed.
Until today, we have three shopkeepers that wouldn't let me pass by without saying, you know, we're not making money anymore because you deleted our parking spot. But I don't agree because I lived here. I studied at the university for 10 years and I never found a parking spot on the street because people park all day and it's not possible. So I think it's a little bit exaggerated. The economic situation has been going down and they're attributing it partly to the street because there was 6 months of complete digging of the street. They really suffered. But what can you do? I mean, you can't renovate something without paying the price. I'm trying to convince them that it's a long-term project. Just give it a year. And people now, already now, people, when they want to come down from Hamra to Bliss, they choose the street.
Off the main road, two parking lots have been filled with interventions. In Beirut, it is law that when a building is demolished, the land it occupied must remain vacant for 2 years. Many landlords use them as pay-for car parks before erecting tall residential towers or office blocks where once stood low-rise buildings.
When a new building comes instead of a heritage building, the problem is that you don't only lose the heritage building and the tree and the garden and the birds, but you lose the permeability on the ground floor because every new building comes with a fence and security cameras and security guards, and this is becomes totally private domain and it becomes alienating. You just are passing next to it. You don't even want to look through because this is really, you know, their space. While in old houses, all these buildings, either the ground floor is actually with windows and you look into them, or there are gardens that have always open doors. So this is what we lose, really. I mean, this is what I really think is the basic loss, is the quality of urban life and the relationship to the city that's being lost rather than just a triple arch house, you know, or a nice engraving on a window. And I think this is the essence of what we're losing. I'm going to go into parking lot. You see the beautiful birds and cats, again, the tiles. Nathalie Harb is a scenographer. and she's proposing a project called the Urban Hives, and it is a raised garden above the car parking lots, because we really have no public gardens in Beirut except in three areas, and people desperately need to see green, to touch green, to feel green. And since we're very short on space, we can't ask somebody to give us a part of his lot to make a garden. We said, why don't you park your cars under your garden? So she actually created a raised garden, and this garden has medicinal plants, edible plants, and decorative plants. So you have rosemary, thyme, basil, and you have gardenias, jasmine, and you have an orange tree, tomatoes. And the residents are very enthusiastic to water it and pick it up. So we said it's just like this 10 by 5 space becomes a place where the community takes over.
Here is Natalie Harb.
The project is an urban hive. This is a module of what can potentially be different ones put together to create a larger garden. The idea is to intervene in parkings, because parking spaces are quite characteristic of urbanization that has developed this way. Before, Beirut was full of gardens in front of houses, and then they gradually got destroyed. When gardens get destroyed, the new developers have no right to build before 2 years. So for 2 years, the land remains either a wasteland or a parking. I mean, with parking, you can actually earn a bit of money. So the idea was to bring back gardens into the parking spots. And this is a very simple scheme, basically. It's to raise a structure above a car and then create on top of it a garden, which is half ornamental and half edible. So basically it provides the community with a kind of allotment and a garden and green spaces where they can come, rest, read, play, and cultivate their plants.
And of course also provide those who own parking lots a kind of selling feature as shaded parking spots as well.
Yeah, of course. This is for, you know, the parking owner, but also because we're looking at ways of funding it. It could also be, you know, because sometimes in parkings you pay a monthly fee. So that would encourage people to pay maybe a little bit more, but then have their own space, have their cars in the shade, but also have their food and also have a green space within their community. And it could also create a community kind of work, you know, like if you take care of a garden together, then that creates a kind of community life.
What seems the great optimism is not to convince developers to create open spaces for public use, as is becoming the standard with larger developments in London, for example, but to add a layer of elements to Beirut that can bring communities together or create them. Some projects at Jeanne d'Arc are fixed, others are temporary, and others still, such as a truck converted into a botanical garden, are mobile.
What was your name?
Nisreen Mashaq Ahouri.
And you're a botanist?
I'm a botanist and ecologist, and I'm head of Biodiversity Commission and Green Hand Organization. We are starting with the mobile botanical garden, and hopefully we will reach the botanical garden. But I think this will keep on going, because the importance of it is the mobility. Because we go to the school. So I was telling someone, for example, instead of the school taking the class to the botanical garden, they will lose the whole day. But when we go to the school, they will only lose one session in their program. And this is also something that's very important for the school, not to lose the whole day to do 1 or 1 hour, you know, in the bus.
The Green Hand Organization is an NGO founded in 2001 that operates throughout the country. And their mobile garden is primarily used for education, running programs for students to help them understand the natural world. But there's another critical element of their work that everyone, and especially every developer here, should be listening to.
An important aspect is to encourage people to use the native plants of the country, and here we're talking about Lebanon, for landscaping. Landscaping their own private gardens or landscaping public spaces. Instead of using exotic or invasive species, let's use our native species, you know, that are beautiful also, and then we would be conserving biodiversity, and it's more sustainable because the native species of an area are adapted to the environment, so they don't need intensive maintenance to keep them.
For example, this is an endemic species, and unfortunately the municipalities think of it as weed, so when it grows in the center of the street, they remove it instead of really caring for it. So this is awareness even to the government officials that be careful, these are native plants. Don't take them off and leave the invasive ones.
Or just try and get them to see them in a more aesthetic, beautiful... It's a beautiful kind of lilac, purple-colored flower.
It's endemic to Lebanon. It's threatened by urbanization, especially because it grows only on the coast.
So Delhi, we were talking about Delhi of Roshi, the last headland. In spring, Delhi is full. It's like blooming with purple. And it will all go if this becomes a resort.
The seafront project Mona mentions is Dalier of Raoche, on the headlands surrounding Beirut's famous pigeon rocks, known as Raoche, which sit just offshore. A private resort project designed by OMA has been on hold. And guess who's been helping lead the campaign?
Activism. We challenged Rem Koolhaas because we thought we are architects and urban planners, and we read his theory and we see his works. And what he says does not apply to what he designed. And we're happy that we got an answer from him, or at least he is aware that people are not happy with this project. We are fighting for the whole coast of Beirut. But Dalier is right next to Raoche. Raoche is the landmark of Beirut. It's on our national money. It's, you know, Raoche. It's like if there's one landmark in Beirut, it's Raoche. So you want to build right next to it. So if somebody comes to take a photograph next to Raoche, he has now to zoom in not to get the resort sign with it. It's not possible. I mean, the integrity of the landscape, it's one natural landscape. So if this cannot be defended, well, how can I defend a small beach in Anfe or a small beach in the south? This has the memory, it has the prestige of the landmark. It is an open geological museum. We have geologists who came and said, because it, you can see the strata by strata. So they said that anybody who knows a bit of geology can actually trace the layers of Beirut just by looking at it. And then it is also an archaeological site, and it was the first Paleolithic flint factory. So half of the flint of the Mediterranean was mined and was tooled in Delhi. So imagine all of this, and they want to dig it by compressors. And we have 91 pieces in the Musée de Confluence in Lyon that are called the stylus of minted Delhi. So, you know, they took them to Lyon, and now we're going to, if we dig, we will find more. They're not allowing them even to start. So it's archaeological, geological, endemic plants. It has endemic flora, and it has marine fauna that is coral reefs and stuff. So what else do you want to defend a place in the city? You tell me, what else do I need?
As Mona will explain, the difficulty in turning public opinion in Beirut isn't out of blind apathy.
And so in your work as a preservationist, or in circumstances like this, trying to save a space from development, how easy or hard is it, or in what ways do you try to engage residents and get them to understand what's at stake?
It's really difficult because people have given up. The war itself has taken a lot of the energy of the people. And when the war ended, they were poor, you know, devastated, their homes are destroyed. And then came Solidaire with the promise of redevelopment. But the downtown was redeveloped not for the people. So today, the people do not go to their downtown. So people lost hope in everything. And they lost hope in fighting in the first place, because if your downtown has been taken over by a real estate development company, your whole downtown, what are you fighting for? Your little street or your little alleyway? If nobody listened to you about your downtown, they're going to listen about your backyard or about your front seat. So in 1999, it was the peak of our public debt. And the government, because Solidaire had taken so much money, and our public debt raised to around, at that time, 35 billion. And everybody was talking about it. So we had the first Ashkal Alwan, one of our first public art organizations, did something on the Corniche. I was at the peak of my fight for Beirut. And this artist friend of mine called Nasser Soumi, he lives in Paris, he said, you know what, I think you're stupid, you just fight for nothing, and I'm going to prove it to you. And I said, what? He said, would you do this project with me? And he came from Paris, and he had a stand on the Corniche for 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, showing maps and drawings of Raoche being cut and taken out by a crane. And he came with his French team, like surveying team, everybody was speaking French, doodling and doing stuff and talking. And so the people on the Corniche, and I was the interviewer, and I was interviewing people. So people came and they didn't understand French. What are they doing? But they saw the photo. Are they cutting Raoche? Yeah, it's a joke. And I said, no, it's not a joke. This is a French company that is, they will not cut Raoche. They have a new system where they can move a mountain even, laser cut. And it can be transformed into a floating platform. And we're thinking that Paris would like to rent Raoche for a year. And they will pay us back 10 billion. And then New York will rent it for a year. So we'll take it through waterways, wherever it can reach, on the condition that after 10 years it will come back. And it took people 5 seconds to stop thinking about that it can be done or not and telling me, so how much are we getting? So you think this will maybe get us our schools for free? It was crazy. It's on video. It's taped. People were ready to give up their national landmark for money. They were ready to accept the idea that somebody will actually cut Rauche and take it somewhere else. And the best part was the Polaroid guy. He came and he listened, and when he understood the thing, the line was, take your last photo with Rauche, take your last photo with Rauche. So even the Polaroid guy was starting to make money out of the fact that Rauche is going to go. So it borders on a joke, but it's really painful that people had so much apathy.
Did that surprise you, or what was your reaction?
I was hurt because my friend was right. Because he was like, you want to defend heritage? You want to defend a building? They're ready to cut Rauche, so go home. But of course, I continued fighting because I really believe that when you don't have anything, you're fighting for your electricity, you're fighting for your children's schooling, you're fighting for your mother's pills, you're fighting for your father's hospital bill. You don't have time either to enjoy it in the first place. And so they're kind of overwhelmed with the simple thing that you as a citizen in London or in the UK do not even think about, because these come to your door. You take it for granted. We fight for it every single day of our lives. I'm a middle-income person, and I have to fight for it every day of my life.
Beirut Design Week has always had a leaning towards design for public good and a focus on impact or possible impact of design. It was founded and is still run by a group of ambitious, switched-on young designers, and it holds onto its positive outlook. We'll end by speaking to Hassan one more time. I ask him what he feels Design Week can accomplish.
You know better how you want to live. They don't, you know. Your ministers, your representatives in the government, those people, the politicians, they really have no idea how people want to live. And I'm not only talking about Beirut. I'm talking every country in the world, you know. In some countries, they manage to convince the population more that this is the right way of doing it. But I think here, people do not believe them anyway. So we know better how we want to live. We know better what's better for us as citizens, as residents, as city dwellers. And I think we can just really decide how we want to live. And if we do our job very well, then we can come up with a really good proposal, and I think they will execute it. And this year we saw some engagement from the public sector that were supportive to Beirut Design Week and other initiatives having during the Beirut Design Week. And it's because we came really well prepared, you know, and it's our responsibility, I think. I'm not sure that designers are aware of the power that they have. I think they limit themselves to very specific outcomes that they think is now trendy or what should be done in terms of design. And I think that design is kind of still perceived as an elitist discipline because of that, because that you're expected as a designer to either design luxury things or anything that has the word design tagged with is 10 times more expensive than anything else, you know, where I think design is really something that should become more popular. I want to popularize design in a way or the other, you know.
And so do you feel then quite optimistic about the future of Beirut and kind of how the city might transform?
Yes.
What gives you that optimism? What has kind of been demonstrated to you in the city where there's been progress and you feel like design hasn't had an influence and where your time and efforts might be valuable?
I think the fact that people are still responsive to calls for action is a very good indicator that things are moving. The fact that people are not passive or they're not just static and they didn't give up is the fact that there is hope that things are going to change one day. And the fact that we launched a few open calls since the beginning of Beirut Design Week 2018 and we got so much response and engagement is actually a great indicator that people are still willing to make a difference.
For Monocle in Beirut, I'm David Michel.
Thanks, David. That was Monocle's contributor, David Michon, reporting for The Urbanist from this year's Beirut Design Week. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Beirut with Elephant Gun. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
If I was young, I'd flee this town, I bet. as did I. We drink to die, we drink to die.